This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy. Professor Jacob Needleman, welcome back to Sphinx Radio.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be with you.
Now, you have a wonderful new book out called What is God? And it is published by Tatcher Press, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Right.
And it is available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And it is a really wonderful, a treasure trove of a book, which I finished, and I'm still going back and rereading sections of it. Now, I know there's a lot of material in it, but what was your primary motivation for writing a book with such a provocative title, What is God?
Well, I've been writing my books, I've always concerned themselves with crafting or discovering the bridge that connects the great wisdom teachings of the ancient traditions with the concrete problems and questions of our everyday life in this culture. And so I'm trying to find the what might call the aching questions of our day, or the problems of our time, and see what light tradition, ancient spiritual truths can throw on this these situations we face. And there's, I've written various subjects like education and money and the problem of our fact that we have no time is running out in our present lives, how difficult it is to have enough time, to press questions about what is the meaning of America. And at the present moment, there's no more agonizing problem than the question of God and what does it mean to speak of God, and why has it been the source of so much evil, the idea of God, and so much good at the same time. So I had a personal relationship with this question from almost the time I can as far back in my life as I can remember. I've been wrestling with this question, going through a long period of atheism and all kinds of things. So I also felt it was time for me to write something of a memoir to show my whole life has been, in a way, a search for understanding the question of God. So a lot of things came together when I wrote this book.
Now, you cover a lot of topics, and they're fascinating, but one thing that struck me is an encounter you had with the famous Japanese Zen scholar D.T. Suzuki. Could you fill us in a little bit about that? That's really part of the book that struck me for some reason.
Yes, well, I had just gotten my degree, my Ph.D. I was getting my Ph.D. at Yale University in philosophy, and I had been written a thesis as an undergraduate at Harvard called On the Subject of What is the Self. I had become very disillusioned with Western religion, and I was getting intrigued with Zen Buddhism, and I had been trying to study the Gurdjieff teaching, and I, through various connections, I made a contact with D.T. Suzuki, whose book, the collection of his essays called Zen Buddhism in 1956, was the main book that really turned Zen Buddhism into something of such interest for the modern Western world, which of course it now is. So it was a very important book, and he was a very important scholar, and also in his way, probably an enlightened master in his own way. And so he had a kind of legendary quality about him, and I was eager to meet him and ask him a question I had prepared so much about what is the self. And I was also so proud of my own academic credentials and what I thought was my intellectual ability. And I went to his place where he was staying in Upper West Side, New York, Manhattan. And my encounter with him was really a remarkable turning point for me, because I very carefully, won't go into all the details which are described in the book, but I very carefully put the question, what is the self, to him, because I had written so much about it and had all the philosophical armaments ready to talk about it with him. And he simply looked at me very quietly with his big eyebrows and a little modest little smile. And he said, he asked me, who is asking the question? Now, this is a reply. I had heard this kind of reply reading books about Zen. And nowadays, when Zen has become so popular, everybody sort of knows those words. But when you really encounter that question in its depth, and that was the first time I had ever had it directed right at me, it completely flummoxed me. And I said, well, I'm asking. And he said again, following great Zen tradition, with that little smile and his quiet presence, show me this eye. And practically everything ended at that moment, and I had no idea what was going on. I was even angry at him a little bit, almost felt insulted that he was asking such a stupid and unanswerable and completely incomprehensible question. And that haunted me for a long time. And I was sort of disillusioned even further about finding anything resembling a higher purpose or a higher power. And then, months later, in the middle of the night, I woke up and stood up, sat up straight in my bed and said, oh my God, that's just the answer. It was something I had to see in myself, for myself. And I didn't know what I was. I didn't know even if I was. And it was such a gift to me to have that kind of a communication, which just didn't just fill me with some intellectually brilliant answer, but made me experience my gut level something about the question of the self. That's why I've been forever grateful to him for that.
That's quite a profound story, and the full narrative of that in the book is really worth taking a look at. Now, to subject hop in the book a bit, another thing that I really think is important socially, you deal with the issue of fundamentalism in different religions, and that's a really tough nut to crack, because with all the problems in the world, fundamentalism has taken on a negative name and kind of a mean sort of slant. But in your book, you show a certain sympathy to those who have ideas that may not agree with yours, and you sort of encourage other people to do the same. Could you tell us a bit about your feelings on just even that word, fundamentalism?
Yes, it was a huge discovery for me, and I think it's really important, because there are fundamentalism, you might call it that, on both sides of the atheism and God debate, both fundamental scientism and fundamentalist Christianity and religion. But it's a word, it's a label, and there are human beings who are fundamentalists, and there are human beings who are fundamentalist scientists. And if we slap a label on all of them and forget that some of these people have hearts and minds just like we do. Not all of them, but some of them. And so there's a lot of evil being put out under that name, and that we have to face and understand. But other people, and this man, this student, for example, came to my class. I write about how I thought at first this was just another fundamentalist. He had carried his Bible. He took the interpreted it literally. He wouldn't hear anything. But this, I said, no, wait a minute. This is a human being. Let me listen to him. And I tried to step back from my thoughts about fundamentalism and listen to the man, the human being. And he started listening to me, too, as a result. And what I discovered is that the thing we need to know most of all about all of this, some people we label fundamentalists, if we just let them in, let them be heard, listen to them, and we don't have to believe them, we don't have to agree with them, but we have to listen to them until we hear the human being speaking. We can go on disagreeing vigorously with what they say, but when we begin to feel that that other person is a human being, that all the poison goes out of the whole situation. And they, when they feel they're being heard and being treated like that, they also lose their poisonous feeling about we who are not fundamentalists. Now, good. What we need most of all is to work at the art of listening to each other. It's a real discipline. It's a real art. It's a spiritual work as well as being a politically and socially necessary skill. So that was my big surprise. I try to say in my book how it happened that the person whom I would have dismissed as a mere fundamentalist turned out to be a very serious and interesting human being who kept his opinions. But the fact that I saw him as a human being, as I say, took all the poison out.
Well, that's a very important point, especially in our day and age. There's a lot of finger pointing and labeling and dismissing people, and that's an important part of really anyone's education.
Yes, you know, and one of the for a democracy to flourish, we have to learn how to listen to each other, and that's being lost. The art of civil conversation is being lost, and without when we lose that, we lose the capacity to think together. When we lose the capacity to think together, we lose democracy.
It really boils down to that. It's a very, very important issue. Now, to subject hop a bit more, you mention in your book different people you've encountered over the years. Is there anyone specifically, I know we mentioned Suzuki, who really struck a chord with you as far as your definition of God?
Yes. Yeah, well, one, I would say two, but certainly the one, it's hard to separate the two of them, but one was one of the great pupil of the teacher, Gurdjieff, G.I. Gurdjieff, a woman named Jeanne de Salzman, and another pupil of Gurdjieff who was I was very close to, one of the other ones, was a man named John Pentland. Those two showed me, through helping me to experience in myself something that I had never believed, I never understood was possible, a quality of interior, what we might call attention, a quality of interior awareness and consciousness that showed me without any question of a doubt, and I was a great doubter, and I had lots of intellectual tools in my mind, and I was an atheist for a long time, and I even when I taught about religion, I down deep, I still didn't believe in God, but when this experience was tasted, I knew this, there really is something greater in the universe and in our own minds, and so I would say, if I had to name one person, it would be Jeanne de Salzman, but the pupils of Gurdjieff, the two or three who were his close pupils, those were the ones that helped me the most.
Oh, very interesting stuff. Now, what is your opinion? You also, just a subject hop again, you knew Jiddu Krishnamurti quite well at one time. What kind of effect did he have on your thinking?
Very, very powerful effect, and it's he was he had discovered on his own that a great secret of the possibility of the transformation of our character into a more benevolent, loving, intelligent being. He discovered the power of the real power, very, very sophisticated, but very simple at the same time, of self-awareness. That awareness of our own minds, awareness of our own hearts, is a transforming force. And now there's a lot of people speaking about that these days, and it's become even a cliche in mindfulness work and all that. And of course, it's a fundamental aspect of certain currents of the great Buddhist tradition. But with him, you saw him working at it when you were with him, as I did with the pupils of the Gurdjieff work, too. When someone is working at this deep down inwardly while they're speaking with you, while they're exchanging with you, it transmits something far more than words. And so what I learned from Krishnamurti is the experience that thinking within words and logic is only a small part of understanding. That something else, the awareness of one's own mind and heart while one is speaking and living produces an understanding and a liberation. And so I see from him, I learned the possibility that it's possible thought is being transformed by the work of awareness. He was truly great. Sadly, he didn't seem able, or didn't find the following, or he rejected all followings, and yet I could tell that he was disappointed somehow that he wasn't able to make what he discovered. He wasn't able to help others come to it very much.
Oh, very interesting point. Now, is there any aspect of this book that you feel would be pertinent to our current political and economic situation, which is an underlying question with everyone now, no matter what you're talking about, be it professional sports or the search for God? What aspects of this book do you think people could utilize the most in these very troubled times we're living in?
Well, I would say so many aspects, but let me start with Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize speech, where he set out in a kind of a visionary but yet very realistic speech when accepting the Nobel Prize, when he set out several conditions, institutional, governmental conditions, which work at keeping the peace even when it required army and even when it required force. It was very sensible, very realistic, etc. But then, toward the end of his talk, he called for a deeper understanding of religion, which he said, all the first three things he was recommending were institutional and governmental and made a lot of sense, but he said he had to leave out the need to think more deeply about religion. And I would say that means to think about God in a new way. And you could tell the echo of what he said, it echoed something so fundamental about the meaning of America that we've lost, which I explored in my book, The American Soul, is that America has you can approach this from the point of view of Thomas Paine in Common Sense in 1776, where he made a distinction between government and society. And he said government must not be confused with society. Government is punitive, it is legalistic, it is sometimes harsh, it's a matter of force and structures. But society is much more delicate, much more inner, much more sensitive. And the purpose of government is to protect society. Well, real religion, which is spirituality, in my opinion, which is the inner search for conscience and a higher influence in one's own life and in the life of the collective, to have a government protecting the ability and the possibility of men and women freely coming together, associating with each other, and trying to find some contact with their own real conscience, that is the strength and the meaning of America in this world. And to me, it's not only second, has nothing to do with ability to buy lots of things, to have a house, to have children, to have a car. All those things do not justify military strength and economic influence, but what does justify it is that we have created a space which is uniquely strong in protecting the freedom of association for the purpose of coming into touch with conscience, which leads to virtue. That's the meaning of America to me.
Oh, that's a very deep, deep insight. And we're about out of time now. I'd like to give out just a little more information about your book for our listeners. The title of the book is called What is God? By Jacob Needleman, and it is put out by Tarcher Press. It is available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. For more information on Professor Jacob Needleman's speaking engagements and other activities, go to JacobNeedleman.com. JacobNeedleman.com, and there's a whole, slew of book signings and different public talks he's given. Well, Professor Needleman, thank you so much for your time. It's always great to have you on. Are there any closing remarks you would like to make?
Well, I would love to have people read this book and feel that there is something. some alternative way that one could really come to contact and search for a higher power in their lives that isn't the conflicted and somewhat foolish, somewhat violent, somewhat harsh, somewhat misguided, simplistic dialogue, if you can call it that, or conflict that's going on, that there is hope in the world, there is hope in ourselves, and so many younger people, as well as all the rest of us, are getting very disillusioned and despairing. So if this book can bring a little bit of hope to the world, I'll be very happy.
Very good, Professor Jacob Needleman. Thank you so much for coming on Sphinx Radio. Will you come back again sometime and give us an update on your activities and writings?
Anytime, Bill. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Very good. Thank you.